Over the years, Joe Alexander has made it his crusade to share his story and speak out loudly against the evils of anti-Semitism. Please welcome a true source of light, a gentle soul, a humble hero, and a champion of courage, Mr. Joseph Alexander.
Thank you, everybody. My name is Joseph Alexander. I'm a Holocaust survivor from Poland, and I survived 12 camps. I come from a small town in Poland, and I come from a small town, and I had a family, I had parents, and 5 siblings, and I'm the only survivor. We had a very good life until 1939. My father was in business, and we had a very good life until 1939, when the Germans came into Poland. They divided Poland in 2 halves. One half was annexed to the Third Reich, to Germany. The second half was Poland under German occupation. We lived on the part where it was annexed to the Third Reich. And as you most of them know, in Europe, every town has a town square. In the town square, that's where most of the business are. We lived in the town square, the second house in one corner of the square, and the third house was an uncle of mine. After a few weeks, the Germans came to town and went past my uncle and around the square and told the people they have 10 minutes to get their possessions and get out in the middle of the square, and they took them away. For some reason, I'll never know why, they left the 3 houses where we were the second house. So rumors started that they're gonna come back 3 days later and take the rest of us. So my father had 3 sisters living about 25 kilometers before Warsaw, which was the second half of Poland. So that said, we're not gonna wait for them to come and give us 10 minutes to get out. So he got out and rented. We had horse-drawn wagons, the deep ones, 6-8 feet deep. And he got a wagon and packed up most of the store from the store. And he put a few pieces of bedding and a couple pieces of furniture on top, because from our part to the other part, they had to go through a border. So that we're moving. And my parents and one sister and brother, they left. I remained with 2 older sisters, and we were loading up a second wagon. In the meantime, the Polish people from around town came to town to buy anything they can get. I sold a man a bicycle and a boat of shirt material. On the way home, he passed the police station, so he got stopped. They wanted to know, where did he get that material? They thought maybe already people started to loot already. He said, I bought it, don't show me a receipt. He said, I don't have a receipt. Then go bring the person who sold it to you. So he came back to me and said, you have to come with me to the police station. If not, they're gonna come here. So I went with them, and they asked me, did you sell them that? I said, yes. Why didn't you give them a receipt? I said, we in Poland, we didn't give receipts. So I took the boat of material, smacked the guy, let him go, and let me go. And I went back, and my sisters waited for me, and we left with the second wagon. We came to a little town named Bologna, about 25 kilometers before Warsaw. And at that time, and there, life was still going on almost normal. But everybody has to go to work. So being there for about 3 weeks, I went to my first camp in 1939. I went to a camp where you work during the week, on the weekends you can go home. But the work we were doing, we were building a canal. You stay in the water up to the knee without boots. And that was October, November already. So I was working there for about 6 weeks, and I got blood poison. I got sores on my arms, on my legs. So after that weekend, I went home, and I said, I'm not going back. So on Monday morning, the police came to look for me. So my dad said, he's not here, he's supposed to be in the camp. So I stayed away from home for a while, and figure things to cool off. I stayed with my friends, my cousins. And that was the time when they started to build in Warsaw a wall where the Warsaw Ghetto was going to be. After they finished building the wall, they came out and ordered all the Jewish people who were living within 50, 60 kilometers in the surrounding area of Warsaw, had to move into the Warsaw Ghetto. So we moved into the ghetto. The life in the ghetto, you couldn't even imagine how miserable, how terrible it was. Because the area they picked out for the ghetto was a small area, and they put in over 400,000 people. Every morning you got out of the house, there were dead people on the streets, on the sidewalks, everywhere. So I lived in the ghetto for about 6 weeks, and we found out back home, nothing's changed since we left. So my parents decided for an older sister, a younger brother, and I, we should go back home. So we go home, we have to get out of the ghetto, so I paid off the guards at the gates to get out. And we said, the sister says, she and her brother, they'll take one street, and I'll take another street, and we walk through town, we'll meet on the outskirts of town. I walked for a few blocks, and I have a Polish teenager comes over and said, give me some money, I'm going to report you. So I figured I gave him some money and I got rid of him and I kept walking. Well, he got on the streetcar, rode the streetcar for a few blocks, and he comes over, give me some more money. So this time I gave him some more money, but I changed the street and I lost him. I walked to the outskirts of town, I met my sister and brother, and we went home. So I came home, I said, nothing has changed since we left. But it only lasted about 3 weeks. After being there about 3 weeks, I came out with an order, all the Jewish men from 16 to 60 report to the schoolhouse. So I report to the schoolhouse and off I went to the camps. The first camp I went to, we were building a dam. You cut down hills, and we had little electric cars, you fill them up, and they take them to another place and they dump it. The work was very hard work. We had to use picks to loosen up the ground. And the food you were getting was a piece of bread like this in the morning, and a cup of coffee, you went to work. You came back from work, you got a soup. Was either the soup was either spinach or the peas from potatoes. Doing that kind of work, you couldn't survive. The only way you could survive is we worked civilians, worked with regular people from town. They came to work in the morning, and in the afternoon after work they went home. So if you could manage to get a little extra food from them, That's the only way you could survive. So I was in a camp in the city of Poznan, and there were camps in the city and around the city. So every morning, they took dead people out, and the camp became very small, and the same thing happened at other camps, so they combined two, three camps into one. And after a while, the same thing happened at this camp. So that's why I kept moving. After this camp, I moved to a job in the city, laying cobblestones on the street. And that lasted a short time. Then I moved to another one, and I was building sewers, laying cement pipes on the ground. After that, I went to another camp. I was a roofer, was doing roofs. And I was going so far from all these camps didn't last too long. Then I went to a camp who was building an airport. I was laying railroad tracks. After being in seven camps, a train arrived, and it wasn't a passenger train, you know, a cattle car train, where they put 30, 40 people to one boxcar. And the destination we were going takes 5 or 6 hours at the most. We were riding around for 3 days, no food, no water, no facilities. Finally, we arrived in Auschwitz. Came to Auschwitz, they opened the doors, but 30-40% of the people were dead on the train already. Whoever could walk, he walked out. He was lined up in rows of five, and I met Dr. Joseph Mengele. Dr. Mengele was called, that was the doctor of death. Dr. Mengele said there are 6 kilometers to walk to the camp. He's going to select some people to go to the left. People on the left are going to be trekking on trucks. So he went through and he picked out sick people, old people, young kids. I was a young kid at the time, and picked me out to go there. But I was already in seven camps, and every camp I went to, had to go to work, I tried to get in with the biggest, strongest man. And here I look around, I see sick people, old people, young kids. That's not the kind of people I like to be with. But my luck was, it was after midnight. It would have been daytime, I don't think I could have done it. When Dr. Mengele moved further down, I ran back to the other side. If I didn't run back to the other side, I wouldn't be here talking to you today. Because the people on trucks were taken, went straight to the guest chamber. So I went back and I walked to Auschwitz. I got a shower and came out of the shower and I got a tattoo. See, 142584. From this moment on, that was your name. You had no name anymore. That was your name. I got a tattoo and then there was Auschwitz II, it's called Birkenau. So I went over to Birkenau, and I was in Birkenau. I saw Dr. Mengele 2 more times in Birkenau, but it was daytime and I was far away from where he was. So I got through, and then I was there until 1943. April of 43, there was a big uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. After the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, they said they needed a big transport, but they didn't want no people from Poland, only people from Hungary, Greece, Italy. But from the end, they were short, about 300 people. So they said, now we'll take some people from Poland. So I had a partner, I was going back to the Warsaw Ghetto the second time. So we came back to the ghetto. There wasn't one house left. All the houses were burned up, just the remaining walls. And our job was to take down those walls brick by brick and clean them up, and put them up in stacks of 8-10 feet high. And then in the meantime, the typhus broke out. Typhus is you get a high fever, high temperature. Anybody I report to the hospital, I never knew anybody who came out of the hospital. I got that high fever, but I didn't report to the hospital. Excuse me. Because I had a, we called a couple, like a foreman. He was a middle-aged German man, but he didn't care if you work or you didn't work. When I had that fever, I was sitting behind those stacks of bricks like this for about 3 days until I got over the fever and went back to work. I went back to work, so I worked for a few days, and the Polish underground attacked our camp trying to free us. So they were fighting all night, but they were unsuccessful. So the next morning, they closed the camp and took us out, and we had to jog to get out of the city. They said they were afraid that the underground may attack us in the city. So we jogged, and they put us up on a big field where the farmers graze their cows and the ground is very moist. So put us up on that field, whatever means you have, a knife, a spoon, anything, you could dig up some mud. And you took the bottom of the shirt and you squeezed the mud to get a little water. So we got a little water and we were on the march. We come to the city and there was a river. So they let us go to the river to get some water. Two of our people went a little farther into the river, and they got shot, they got killed right in the river. So we got some water, and we were walking, and we came the next day, we come to another city, and there was the same river. But they said, this time only 100 people at a time can go to the river to get some water. So when we got some water, and then we were walking, and that day it was very heavy rain coming down. You could hardly walk. You were soaking wet. You couldn't even walk. Until we got to a railroad station, and we got on the same train, right? And we were on the train for 3.5 days this time, with no food, no water, no facilities, anything. And we were going to Germany, to a camp named Dachau. We went to Dachau. We came to there. Finally, after 3.5 days, we arrived. So I was in Dachau for about 2 weeks doing nothing, because they were establishing within 50, 60 kilometers, 12 camps, all by numbers, 1 to 12. After 2 weeks, I went to camp number 1, and I was working for a farmer digging potatoes. That lasted about 3 weeks. And then I went sent to a camp about 50 kilometers from Dachau to a city of Landsberg am Lech. And that was camp number 7. Camp number 7, we were a small group. We were on the camps already for over 4 years. So we had the privilege of getting the better jobs. Friends of mine got some jobs to work in the kitchen. 3 of them were the police in the camp. And that was the only camp I was where women were in the same camp, but they were blocked off one corner by a wire fence, but we went to work together. So I got a group of 10, we were 5 girls and 5 boys, to work in the kitchen for the German guards outside the camp. And another 2 men in charge of the kitchen, but they were very good to me. They were very nice men. Every day after I go back to the camp, I took some food back from friends, and we always had some soup left over. So I took one of those milk cans we had and put it in, And the next morning, people were going to work. They passed by our kitchen. So I stopped them and I gave them some food. A couple of times, the officer in charge of the guards complained that I'm holding up the people going to work. But my people told me, don't worry about it, let them talk, do what you're doing. And that lasted about 6 weeks, but until April 28, 1945, all the 12 camps had to go back to Dachau. Went back to Dachau, stayed overnight, and the next morning we go on a march, what they call a death march. They're supposed to take us into the mountains in Germany. There's a ski resort named Garmisch, and kill us in the mountain there. Well, we walked about 2 days, and we knew we were not going to be walking too far, because we could hear the fighting. We knew that the American troops are not far behind us. So we walked about 2 days and crossed a little bridge, and the little bridge was blown up. So our group was divided in two halves. I was on a half on a bridge where it was Königsdorf. And it was a little forest in there. So they took us into the forest and they asked for volunteers to take the sick people into the farmers and put them into the barn. One of the farmers, one of the volunteers, was a friend of mine. And on the way back, they found a dead horse in the snow. So they cut up some pieces from the horse, and a friend of mine came and brought me that piece of horse meat and told me to do something. So I made a fire and I was barbecuing. And that was the best meal you can have. This was the friend of mine. His name was Joe Buddha. And that was the best meal we had in a long time. So then, during the night, the guards disappeared. So the next morning, the police came and they took us into the village and they disappeared. That was in the morning, about between 8, 9 o'clock. So we walked around the village and see what's going to happen next. So I walked around till about between 12 and 1 o'clock. American tank moved in and we were liberated. And behind the tank were the American troops. So they tried to block off the village, not to let anybody out. But we were 9 of us. We were in the camps already over 5 years. We didn't want to get blocked in, so we broke through and started to walk to see where the next town is. So we walked about 1 or 2 kilometers, and there was a bakery. So we got into the bakery, everybody got a bread. You had a bread, you were okay. And we walked a little further and we come into a town named Bad Telz, about 40 kilometers from Munich. And you see 3 American soldiers, but they were Czechoslovakian descent. They were walking, they were trying to walk. They couldn't even walk, they were holding on to each other. They were so drunk that they couldn't even walk. But I guess the clothes we were wearing, they asked, are you Polish? We told them, yes. They said, come on. And they took us into a bunker, underground bunker. It was a warehouse. You couldn't see the end of it. So everybody changed clothes, put on fresh clothes. You took a backpack to put some food in. And there was a big row of bicycles chained up. So they broke the chain and everybody got a bicycle. Now we have to find a place to stay. Because when the American troops came in behind the tank, they brought all the people to that city. It used to be a German Air Force base, and they made a DP camp, a displaced person camp. But we didn't want to go out to a camp. But where we were, you couldn't get out because it was after 6 o'clock. And 6 o'clock was curfew. So after 6, so they couldn't get out, so we hopped over about 3 or 4 fences, and we came to a German inn that was taken over by the American troop. But in the back of the inn was an empty house, so we took over the house. We stayed in the house about 10 days, and there came out the order, anybody who lives outside of the camp has to move into the camp. So we moved into the camp, we were taken back to another camp in Munich, but you are free. You want, you can live in the camp or you can go any place you want. So I lived in the camp there about 3 days, and a couple of friends of mine and I decided to go back to the city of Landsberg, where camp number 7 was. And Landsberg at that time was one of the biggest DP camps. There was a lot of DP camps in Germany, but Landsberg was one of the biggest ones. So I went to the camp and registered, and they gave me a room, and I stayed overnight. The next morning, I moved out about 7 kilometers from town to a farm, and I lived in a farmhouse. The reason we went to camp to register to all the other camps, or this camp, because when I got out of the Warsaw Ghetto, I left my parents, 2 sisters and 1 brother in the Warsaw Ghetto. Until today, I don't know what happened to them. So that's why we went to register to look. So if anybody survived, they can want to look through the list. So I lived in a farmhouse about 6 weeks, and I decided to go back to Poland, go back to my hometown, go to the house and see if anybody returned. So I went to the house and had survivors living on the second floor, and Polish people lived on the first floor. But I said nobody, my immediate family, came back. The only one who came back was a cousin of mine. He was 2 years younger than I, and I was with him and 2 of his uncles, 2 of his father's brothers. And when we came to Auschwitz, when Dr. Mengele told me to go to the left, that's when we got separated. But he survived, the uncles didn't survive, but he was in a different town. So, yeah, that was him here. We had the same last name. His name was Mark Alexander. That's him right here. So he was in a different town, and at that time it was very bad for survivors who came back to Poland. They killed a lot of survivors because when they took the Jews out of the homes, they moved in, Polish people moved in, and now some of the survivors came back. They didn't want to give up the homes, so they were killing a lot of survivors. So the people who were living on my house on the first floor, the Polish people, they said desperately, if I'm going to stay, they'll move out. I told them, don't bother. I went and I picked up my cousin where he was, and we went back to Germany. And I lived in Germany for 4 years after I was liberated. Well, in Germany from 45 to 49, because you couldn't go any place, I didn't have a passport. So I had to wait until some country opens up. After 4 years, Canada said, they'll take some people. Then, So Canada said they'll take some people, so I went and I registered. And then you have to wait until they call you. Took a long time, I didn't call. So in the meantime then, a friend of mine living in the next village came and said he could go now to Munich and register to go to America. So I went to Munich and I registered and took about 2 weeks. I had a notice to go get checked out by an American doctor and by the FBI to check you out. And then I got a note to go to Bremerhaven, that's a port in Germany, where the boat was, to go to get the boat. And I got on the boat and I arrived in New York on May 30th, 1949. You came to New York, everybody had to have a sponsor. Either you had some relatives here or an organization to sponsor you. I didn't have any relatives here, so I was sponsored by a Jewish organization named Joint. And my contract was Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I was sent to Harrisburg, and I got a job as a tailor working for a man who had a cleaning store and a tuxedo rental. That man, his name was Max Kaplan. A father couldn't be better than he was to me. And so I was there for a while, and then my cousin who survived had an uncle here in Santa Monica. So he came later. When he came to Santa Monica and told the uncle that I'm in Pennsylvania, and we were the only two survivors from both of our families. So that uncle called me a few times, I should come here. So in 1950, I came to California, and I'm still here. Now, if you have any questions for me, I'll be happy to answer you. Yeah.
Being that you came to the U.S. in 1949, did you ever think, or was it ever an option for you to go to Israel instead of the U.S.?
No. I know it wasn't an option, but I think, you know, I think God didn't want me to go to Israel. Tell you why. Two times. One time, I had a brother, which I took his name. This is not my birth name, Joseph. He was in a kibbutz in Poland for 6 months in 1938 to get a visa to go to Israel. And at that time, England had the Balfour Declaration. And Balfour was the one who was handing out so many Jews from Poland a year can go to Israel. When my brother finished the 6 months, he cut the quota in half. So my brother had to wait, and the war broke out, so he didn't get to go. After I was liberated, I told you I was liberated in near Bartels. Israel had a Haganah who were fighting with the British during World War II. They came through and they asked if anybody wants to go with them. We were 12 boys ready to go. So they said they're going to Belgium. On the way back, they'll pick us up. So meantime, they forgot where we were. They went a different way, they didn't come back. That's why I say, see, God didn't want me to go to Israel. They went a different way, they didn't come back. If they would come back, I would have gone. So that's why I didn't go to Israel. But I've been back to Israel twice to visit. Yes?
How would a woman, a young girl, have survived that? My mother was the only survivor in her family that came out from Auschwitz. How would she have survived? How could a young girl have survived?
Where was she from?
Poland.
Poland? Well, thank God. Yeah, we had a few survivors, not too many from Poland. Most survivors you see here are from Hungary. Because Hungary, they were still home till 1944. They didn't take to the camps until 44. So we have some survivors from Hungary. It was not too many from Poland.
First of all, you're an amazing man.
Thank you.
When you found yourself in those camps, did you understand what was going on, the gravity of the whole situation? They were trying to methodically exterminate the Jews, or was it just purely survival? What were your thoughts? What do you think they were trying to accomplish?
Well,
back.
No, what happened? We didn't know, we took it day by day. You didn't know if the next day if you're going to be alive. So you took it day by day, but everybody tried, whatever you can, to survive. And you know, today, there's a lot of anti-Semitism going on and Holocaust deniers. You know, 6 million Jews were murdered, 1.5 million children. They weren't murdered because they were criminals or did anything wrong, just because they were Jews. And today we have a lot of anti-Semitism going on, and a lot of Holocaust deniers. I call those Holocaust deniers, they're crazy. Because the evidence today is still in existence in all the camps today. You go to Auschwitz, Birkenau, Majdanek, Treblinka. The camps are still there, and you see every day you see buses. We were back several times, several of them. And you see buses every day, people coming from all over the world to witness the gas chambers. So that's why I call the Holocaust deniers, they're crazy. Yeah.
Kind of like what you started on. At what point did people start to realize that something was going on and that things like this were going to happen? And I ask that because, like, in light of all the anti-Semitism today, I find that some people that I talk to say to me, oh, don't talk about that. I don't want to hear about that. Like, they're busy living their lives, working, dancing, whatever they want, music, TV. And I'm trying to tell people, wake up. And I don't know, you know, what to do by myself. I think the synagogues need to get together and do something. But what do you suggest that people like us do today to get people to wake up? I mean, I'm from the East Coast. And I just saw that there's somebody running as mayor who's an anti-Semite who said that if Netanyahu comes into this country, he will have him arrested.
Whether
he
has
to
him.
He's not leading it.
And
he's
so
not leading
Jews don't understand. They have to get out and vote.
Yeah.
And just what do we do to what do we do? I don't know. I feel like I'm at a loss.
Well, don't give up. And stay tall. Don't be afraid to say that you're Jewish. Because a lot of people ask me, well, you're Armenian or Italian. I said, no, I'm Jewish. Don't be afraid to say it. And stay strong. And that's all. That's all we can do. I hope for the best.
Going through everything that you went through as a young boy, what gave you the strength to continue and to survive?
I was determined to survive, no matter what. I said, I have to survive. I speak to a lot of hundreds of thousands, I think, high school students. high school, middle school, and high school. And I tell them, you know, when I was in Birkenau, I saw people in Birkenau running to the electric fence to get electrocuted or being beaten to death because they gave up. So a lot of the kids ask me, did you ever think of giving up? I said, no, I never did. I never lost faith. I never stopped believing in God. And I said, I may have a bad day today, but I hope tomorrow will be a better day. Never give up. Yes.
Ways, like was it luck, was it faith, was it craftiness, was it, you know, how do you think you were able to get through all that? Because you could have been in any one of those, you could have met a much worse fate, but you didn't, and you went through all those things. What do you attribute that to? Is your faith in God, was God protecting you, or just your craftiness, or let me, you tell me.
Because it was what it was to me. I didn't try to escape because I had to watch three hangings. People trying to escape, they got cut. Right. And on Sunday, we had to gather around watching being hung. That's what happened for somebody who tried to escape.
Question here.
How were they expecting you to be able to work if they gave so little food? They didn't give you any energy. How did they expect you to work so hard?
Well, how did they didn't care. They didn't want you to survive. They want you to die. So that's why they give you little food. That's why the only way, like I say, you survive, because we were civilians. And you have to manage, if you manage to get just a little extra food, that's the only way you could survive. They didn't want you to survive. Yes?
Can you tell us what came of your life once you moved to Santa Monica?
Mm-hmm. What became of your life once you moved to Santa Monica?
What was my life? Well, when I came to California, actually, the cousin of mine who survived, he is an uncle in Santa Monica. And then he also had a shop in the Riverside, a military uniform. So we worked there in the Riverside for a while. And that was 1950, the Korean War started. In Victorville, if you know where Victorville is, there used to be a big Air Force base in World War II. In 46, they closed the base. Now in 1950, the Korean War started, they reopened the base. So we got a contract, it had a tailor shop at the base. And I was with my cousin, and I was there for 7 years. And I used to come to Los Angeles almost every weekend. After being there a victim for 7 years, I said, I'm going to Los Angeles, and I'm going to open a store in Los Angeles. So I came in 1957. I came to Los Angeles. And I got a partner. I had several people wanted to go and partner with me. So I got picked one partner I knew. And we opened a store on Melrose, next block from Paramount Studio. It was called the Los Angeles Uniform Exchange. A uniform st- of military uniforms. And I was there for 38 years. And most of the movies and TVs, the militaries that you saw, were uniformed from our store. So I was there for 38 years and I retired. 94, I retired.
When you got help from the local civilians and you got some food from them and you talked with them, did they have any idea what was going on in the extermination that was?
Yeah, of course they knew. That's where we got the news. That's how we knew. We knew everything what was going on. Yeah. Well, they were just going to work. They went to work in the morning and went home and left to work. Yeah.
I had a professor in college who lost his mother and father in the Holocaust. And now, during class and like online, he's a very outspoken anti-Semite. He doesn't believe in God. He says the whole thing that what happened to his parents, you know, changed his perspective on religion, Judaism. So seeing you like being so proud of being Jewish and have such a strong faith in Hashem, how do you keep that? Because of like everything that you went through, how did you remain so devoted and how did you keep your belief in God?
Because you know what? This is the way I grew up. When I was 10 years old, I belonged to a Jewish Zionist organization, the Chalutz. I was a Chalutz, a Shomer. Since I was 10 years old. That's why my brother went to the kibbutz in Poland. See, we were all getting together. We had a good, very good time. We had a club. We used to meet every night. So until 1939, everything fell apart. So this is why, the way I grew up, you know.
I have one question. Is it possible you give everyone a bracha, a blessing? We have everyone in this room who needs a blessing for something else. Can you give everyone a bracha?
Sure. You mean you want me to give a bracha for the whole everybody? Yeah, sure. Yivarech Adonai v'yishmarecha.
Amen.
Yusam Adonai Seim Shalom.
Amen.
Shehecheyunu v'kimunu v'hegiyunu l'azman hazeh.
Amen.
Thank you so much.